Welcome to The Social Network Show. How do you feel about social technology and this connected, networked world we live in? Your host of The Social Network Show, Dr. J, interviews informed and entertaining guests to tackle the most pressing digital issues of interest to business professionals and nonprofit leaders, to parents and educators, and to anyone wondering where all this is taking us. And now, your host, experimental psychologist, Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. That is the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, part of the Bill of Rights comprised of the first 10 amendments. Life has changed a great deal, of course, since 1791, when the Bill of Rights was ratified, less than 3 years after the Constitution itself. But many court cases are still decided on the basis of the First Amendment. As someone interested in the changes brought about by the internet communication, you will enjoy hearing what today's guest has to teach us about the concept of free speech and the struggles to apply it in this age of instant and far-reaching communication. You will hear today from a First Amendment scholar, a professor of government at Wesleyan University, located in Middletown, Connecticut. Professor John Finn is an internationally recognized expert on constitutional theory and the First Amendment. Dr. Finn, welcome to the Social Network Show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, on the Social Network Show over the past few years, we've dealt extensively with the issue of cyberbullying and cyber abuse experienced by people of any, regardless of their age. And frequently, internet service providers and social network owners have taken a hands-off policy saying that they do not wish to hamper freedom of speech. So that's the background issue that kind of looms for me as we discuss the First Amendment. And I have been listening to your lecture series, The First Amendment and You, What Everyone Should Know, from The Great Courses, where you point out that the internet isn't the first innovation in communication to have caused similar confusion and chaos. Could you give us an example of how matters have been resolved in past, dealing with past innovations?
That's an excellent question. And, you know, if you think about it, pretty much every communication technology that we take for granted was invented, you know, after 1791. So early on, you can imagine there were all sorts of fascinating issues about how do you handle communications over the phone. And then there were, you know, the development of radio in the early to mid 20th century. Radio presented all sorts of problems, still does in some ways, for First Amendment jurisprudence. And then think again to the development of broadcast television and then cable television and then finally the internet, or video phones for that matter. All of these have at some point struck courts as being really profound innovations that raise really unique problems for the First Amendment. But on further reflection, I think most of the time the court has concluded that the way to handle new technologies is not to invent new constitutional rules from scratch, or to create a distinct set of rules that are unique to whatever the new form of communication is. Instead, the court tries to adapt its existing rules and doctrines, the one it uses for older, if not outdated, technologies to the new world. And, you know, more often than not, that approach takes time, and it doesn't completely solve problems because every new technology is unique in its own way. But that said, I do think actually the court has been fairly successful at integrating new technologies into existing First Amendment jurisprudence. So to give you just sort of one quick example of this, you know, compared, say, to print media, when radio really became popular, you know, the justices were struck, as I suppose many of us were, with how pervasive and extensive the influence of radio media could be. I mean, it was very difficult to avoid, and eventually the court, you know, got around to deciding a really fascinating case involving FCC regulations, you know, concerning the broadcast of obscenity. So there's this fascinating case, and I'm sure many of your readers will know, or your listeners will know of the sort of underlying facts. It involved a decision by a Pacifica radio station in California, I think, to broadcast the old George Carlin Seven Dirty Words stint during the middle of the day. And several of listeners said, hey, I've got kids in my car, I really object to this. So the FCC tried to shut it down. And the court ultimately concluded that, you know, the rules that generally governed obscenity would be more or less the same rules that would govern the broadcast of obscenity over radio, but there were also unique features such as its pervasiveness and your inability, in effect, to get away from it and its sort of easy exposure to children that the court ultimately concluded made broadcast radio a little bit more subject to intrusive regulation than, say, the print media traditionally had been.
Oh, because it itself you wouldn't have to deliberately go and seek it out. It could just intrude upon your airwaves.
Yes, absolutely. And then, to see how these problems recur over time, I don't have any personal knowledge of this, but I have heard that there are, websites and dial-in phone services where listeners can get access to pre-recorded, pornographic materials. And there was an obvious sort of question about whether or not the federal government or state governments ought to have the right to shut that kind of pornography down. And there the court said that the fact that you actually had to make a concerted effort to get that material, and that it was possible for companies to set up filters that might excuse minors, made it very different than broadcast media. So each time we get a technological revolution in communications, there are unique sort of twists that are posed by the nature of the technology itself. But the court's instinct is to try to resolve it through traditional tools of analysis.
Well, I know that most of our listeners are lifelong learners like me, and so just a word to my listeners right now, I think you'd love the great courses as much as I do. I recently listened to the audio lecture series that Dr. Finn is talking about, which he gave in a series of lectures, 12 lectures on the First Amendment and You, What Everyone Should Know. This course explores how the First Amendment, just 45 words, is actually a pillar of American democracy and also the impact it has on our culture. Right now, you can order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including The First Amendment and You, What Everyone Should Know, at up to 80% off their original price. But this 80% savings is, as you might suspect, available only for a limited time. Order today, then. Go to thegreatcourses.com/social. That's thegreatcourses.com/social to see these wonderful courses and put your order in. So I think that now, Dr. Finn, in those lectures, you really cover a lot of ground about the First Amendment, even what speech is. we would think that's a pretty simple thing, but it turns out, of course, that it's not. You've touched on pornography and obscenity as being tricky areas, but what about hate speech? This is something that we have come across a lot with regard to people, trolls, internet trolls that kind of make it. It's a whole culture of people, mean-spirited people, I think we can definitely say that, it doesn't really seem to have anything to do with promoting a civil society or sharing their views or anything that the government would not, would consider trying to overthrow the government. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is a fascinating area for me, and I suppose like most people who are sort of moderately familiar with the trolls, my general experience is don't feed the trolls, but that doesn't always make them go away, of course. In fact, sometimes it seems to provoke them. But part of what I like about this subject is, for as long as human beings have been communicating, there has been hate speech of one sort or another. And while we're inclined to think it's a unique problem with the internet, it's been a problem in First Amendment jurisprudence for a long time. So there's an older doctrine known as the Fighting Words Doctrine, which was really developed in the 19th 1940s and beyond by the Supreme Court, which involved people standing in the sort of public square and yelling really obnoxious, sometimes deeply hateful things to other people. And the Supreme Court developed this rule that said, if you are guilty of using fighting words, and then it went on to define fighting words as words that would likely provoke a reasonable listener to a breach of the peace or to violence, perhaps, that those words weren't protected because they did not, in fact, advance any kind of socially meritorious speech in any meaningful way. They were no contribution, the court said, to the exposition of ideas. So the idea that you might shut down hate speech on the same rationale is not at all, you know, unfamiliar. It reaches back, as I said before, to, you know, older doctrines that the court might or might not think are appropriate here. Generally speaking, though, this court, in fact, the courts of the last 20 years or so have been fairly reluctant to expand the idea of hate speech or fighting words more broadly. So I think probably the best place to start is to assume that most hate speech is going to be constitutionally protected unless it constitutes a direct threat to another human being. Usually by direct, I mean face-to-face, and that, of course, raises really sort of unique issues in the internet context. And it usually has to be the kind of word that simply wouldn't be enough to set me off or perhaps to set you off, but it would have to be the sort of direct, provocative insult that would set a reasonable person off. And of course, we can disagree in hard cases about, you know, what those words would be, but I think you could assume that, you know, racial slurs in certain contexts might be fighting words, but I would start from the presumption that most of the time they're actually going to be protected, even though they're hateful.
That is a big problem, though, as you say, if it had to be face-to-face. We don't live in a face-to-face world anymore. That is one of the big changes, I think, that puts all of this into a different context. I have a hard time getting my head around this in the sense that the harms that are committed or result from this type of thing can be very real, can be very, and by that I mean in a physical sense. I try to say cyberspace is just as real as the face-to-face world because of that. So do you see any, the other issue there is in terms of fighting words, is everybody going to fight over words? I can't imagine getting physically violent over words, no matter what they were. So it's, do you think that is hearkening back to another era? Help me out with this.
Well, those are excellent questions. So let me just go back to the original case then that sort of started this doctrine. It was called Chaplinsky versus New Hampshire, and it involved a member of the Jehovah's Witness saying things that some people would have found truly offensive, I'm sure. He called members of the local police force goddamned fascists and racketeers. And when I teach this case, you know, to students or, you know, to adult audiences, I get very different reactions. My students, you know, who are roughly 18 to 22 or 23, they can't imagine that anybody would be spurred to violence by being called a fascist. I mean, they sort of take for granted that everybody will be called a fascist at some point in their life. But I try to tell them, you know, for an earlier generation, that term might have resonated more. In ways that I can't completely understand, and I really don't understand at all why being called a racketeer would offend somebody. But again, you know, maybe these words have to be understood in their context. The bigger question you ask is, should anybody be provoked to violence or that? And, you know, I guess the court has, I think, has been tended to sort of move away from that theory on the idea that words can harm, yes, but they shouldn't lead immediately to breaches of the peace. Here's another way I try to get at this problem. You know, it's so easy, especially for people like me, to say, well, you know, the First Amendment is just about the most cherished value we have constitutionally, and certainly it is. I mean, it's be impossible to imagine constitutional democracy without freedom of speech, but I've never much put stock into that old phrase, you know, sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words can't hurt me. No, words can and do hurt, particularly racist, ageist, misogynistic speech. That stuff, I think it's a mistake to start from the assumption that the damage those words do isn't real. So for me, you know, the really difficult question here is, at what point does freedom of speech generally begin to impinge on other constitutional values, like respecting the dignity and equality of other citizens? And I'm not saying references to dignity and equality trump speech, but I also think it's equally simplistic to assume that speech is always the most important value. I mean, to me, these are hard cases.
Right. That's very true. It's all a question of balancing one against the other. I'd like to just throw in a thought or two about Chaplinsky. We're only halfway through, so we can go into that a little bit in the second half of our show. And you are listening to The Social Network Show with my guest, Dr. John Finn from Wesleyan University. And this is your host, Jane Karwoski.
Questions? Comments? Reach out to us. Our email address is questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com or find us on Twitter @SocialNetShow.
People across the globe are tuning in to the podcast show Women Worldwide with host Deirdre Breckenridge as she highlights the adventures of her amazing guests, from neuroscientists and psychotherapists to movie executives and entrepreneurs. On the show, women share their incredible journeys filled with tough challenges and great achievements. They impart advice and educate through their personal experiences so that you can learn and grow and tap into your own inner strength and potential. Women Worldwide, like the Hashtag Show and the Social Network Show, are available on thesocialnetworkstation.com. You're listening to The Social Network Show. We're talking with Dr. John Finn about the First Amendment. And you've also, before we get back into our program, you've been hearing about the high-growth digital marketing industry. It's filled with exciting opportunities. So I encourage you to visit dmipostgrad.com to download a brochure from the Digital Marketing Institute and find out why earning their postgraduate diploma in digital marketing is the perfect way to get ahead. The postgraduate diploma is designed, developed, and taught by industry experts with knowledge of cutting-edge trends and specialist experience. They will help shape you into an accomplished digital marketer with a skill set that covers everything from mobile, social media, and search marketing to digital strategy and planning. DMI has equipped over 10,000 students with the skills and knowledge they need to excel in the digital industry. Again, I encourage you, whether you want to secure a new job or move up in your current organization or grow your own business, visit dmipostgrad.com and download a brochure for the Digital Marketing Institute's postgraduate diploma in digital marketing and start realizing your digital career goals. Now, I don't think they teach anything about the First Amendment, though, so it's a good thing we've got Dr. Finn here. You had mentioned, and I believe you said on the course that this is your favorite course or your favorite case of all time, I guess, Supreme Court case was Chaplinsky versus...
New Hampshire,
right. I found that a little bizarre because I know many witnesses, and I know that goddamned anything is not in their normal vocabulary.
Right, absolutely, and, right.
But, of course, the idea that religion was a snare and a racket was not uncommon. That was in the 40s, was it?
Yes, it was, yes.
Uh-huh. And, of course, anybody being called a fascist or a Nazi, et cetera, had a lot more punch then. Although, I'm afraid we're kind of getting to the point where it isn't just dead history anymore, judging from
some people. No, I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, they call it Godwin's Law, right? Every argument on the internet eventually results in somebody calling somebody a Nazi.
And that's another issue that is involves free speech and the internet, because some countries, I believe France and Germany, do not tolerate, for instance, sales of Nazi memorabilia or such things. And that gets into some tricky areas of how to restrict things on the internet for people in certain areas of the earth. How does that?
Yes, that's absolutely true. Yes, and that's a fascinating question when you think about it, right? I mean, because technically speaking, I mean, more than technically, practically, the First Amendment is a set of standards that really only governs, you know, the United States. Although I would say that, you know, the First Amendment has been fantastically influential in most of the Western world, at least. It is true, though, that we probably in the United States go further to protecting speech than pretty much any other constitutional democracy.
Well, that goes back to where we left off in the idea of trying to balance. Just sort of a little mantra or motto of mine is that you cannot give unlimited priority to anything in your life or in theory, whatever. And if you give unlimited priority to free speech, you end up trampling on other principles that are just as important. Can you think of cases where it was restricted because of that?
Well, yeah, actually, it's a great philosophy. I might steal it from you. And second, I think it's absolutely true. And hate speech is one of them. But let me give you a sort of more contemporary example, since Chaplinsky is, we're not going, what, on 75 years old or so. The sort of modern version of Chaplinsky is best represented by a case called RAV versus the City of St. Paul, which involves the burning of a cross on the lawn, the front lawn, if I recall correctly, of an African-American family. And that action of burning the cross would have been illegal and against the law on a lot of different grounds. It would have constituted a threat. It would have been a violation of property laws. It would have been trespass, a whole number of different things. But it also violated a Minneapolis St. Paul, I believe it was Minneapolis, ordinance that said that this sort of thing was in fact hate speech and was subject to its own unique sort of criminal penalties. The court said that it understood what the statute was trying to do. It was trying to balance our commitment to free speech against these values, for example, of dignity and equality and to be a racially diverse, pluralistic society. The court was completely, I think, at least it said it was completely sympathetic to the competing tensions. But in the end, it said, the commitment to speech had to outweigh the others in this particular instance, but that's not always true. So another word you used that I really liked is the word absolutist. The court has been really clear, I think, that while it puts a really high value on freedom of speech, it's not an absolute value that trumps everything else. There are times when it's perfectly within the state's authority to limit speech. Religion might be the best example of this, however. So, you may believe as intently as you want to, and as deeply and as sincerely as is humanly possible, that your religion entitles you, for example, to steak, every Sunday. But that doesn't mean the state can't interfere with it. And that's a silly example, but think of really serious ones. What if your religious principles, for example, tell you that you should not bring a very possibly deathly ill child to medical treatment at the local hospital? And we know there are religions that do believe this, and we know this case happens with a fair degree of frequency. At that point, the court will usually step in and they'll say, look, you might be free as an adult to make that decision, but your freedom of religion doesn't trump your child's right and society's interest in protecting your child's right to survive. But generally speaking, the court has developed a whole series of elaborate tests and doctrinal rules. We go over some of them in the course. One of the most common is known as the strict scrutiny rule. But all of these rules are just ways, tools that the court uses to try to balance these competing interests.
Well, it certainly shows that there's many deep, deep issues, deep questions here, and you do a marvelous job of looking into them and guiding your listeners in the course through some of the complexities of the First Amendment. And I want to tell you how much I appreciate your being on the show today, and certainly urge my listeners to check out that course at thegreatcourses.com/social. Thanks a lot, Dr. Finn.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the opportunity to speak with you.
Oh, thank you. And thank you to our listeners. And please do check out our website at thesocialnetworkshow.com and check out the blog. That's where we have a lot of the archives and you can learn a lot there. You can also find us on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, and get our app at your app store. Thanks a lot, and please be careful, be safe, and have fun online and off until we meet you here again.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the worldwide show dedicated to social media networking and understanding the connected, networked world we live in. Listen to our archive shows on thesocialnetworkshow.com and follow us on Twitter at Social Net Show. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia Incorporated. The views and opinions expressed are those of our host and guest and may not be the views and opinions of Social Network Intermedia.